Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. It's a difficult, delicate thing to talk about, but talk about it we must. Suicide is a public health issue that affects people of all ages, all races and ethnicities. Nationally, the suicide rate has increased by just over 25% since 1999, with nearly every state in the U.S. experiencing increases during this time period. And that's what makes a special week of September so important. Melinda Moore is a licensed psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Eastern Kentucky University, and she's here to tell us about it and what's going to be happening on campus. Thanks for stopping by, Dr. Moore.
Thank you very much.
So before we get into the details of Suicide Prevention Week, bring us up to date on the data and the situation in Kentucky.
Yeah. Well, suicide is an increasing problem, not just in Kentucky, but nationally. Over 47,000 Americans die by suicide every year. And in Kentucky, over 700 Kentuckians die by suicide every year. In the most recent reporting year, 770 Kentuckians died by suicide.
Any particular age group seeing increases, or is this spread across the spectrum?
Well, you know, we tend to see increases at both ends of the age spectrum. So those individuals who are younger, individuals who are 10 to, let's say, 34 years of age, and then those who are older, particularly men 65 years of age plus, tend to have the higher rates of suicide. In 2010, however, we did see a spike of individuals in the middle of their life. And that was probably related to the economic downturn of 2008. So we are still seeing that trend. But typically when we think of suicide risk, we think about it on either ends of the age spectrum.
That's really interesting, because we do hear that while we're out of the recession, of course, and the economy has been in pretty good shape in recent years, there are an awful lot of people out there that are still experiencing stress, that are not seeing their wages improve, therefore their budgets are strained to the point of distress and despair. Does that resonate with what you're hearing?
Well, I think we certainly have evidence that economic factors might possibly contribute to distress and suicide risk, but certainly lack of resources, having access to mental health care. And that's why suicide is primarily a rural problem, not an urban problem. In urban communities, you have people that are living more closely, perhaps providing more support. They also have more resources. But people in rural communities tend to have to drive really far distances in order to get access to good mental health care. There also may be some prevailing stigma that may contribute.
How do you know if somebody is inclined to do this to themselves? Is it something that people tend to communicate, or is it something that people generally keep to themselves?
The only way you're going to know if somebody's having thoughts of suicide is to ask them. I think it makes people feel comfortable to think that we have warning signs that we can know and then be able to apply to individuals who we're in contact with. But I think if you recognize that somebody's just a little off, they just seem a little off to you, they don't seem to be like themselves, asking them that question, you know, I'm really worried about you. Are you having thoughts of suicide? You know, or if you did, I would hope you would let me know.
Mm-hmm. Well, there surely are all kinds of reasons that drive people to this, but are you seeing any particular drivers beyond the economic factor?
Well, in June 2018, the CDC came out with a report and said that over half of individuals who die by suicide do not have a diagnosable mental illness. And, you know, the prevailing notion in suicidology and in mental health care has been that people who die by suicide probably have some sort of diagnosable mental illness. So that really told a lot of us in this area, you know, that we had to be looking for other things. There are many roads to Rome. And so that's why it's really important for not just clinicians, you know, the clinicians that I train in our Department of Psychology, the EKU Clinical Psychology Doctoral Program, to ask the right questions. But people in the general public need to be able to ask the right questions just so that we can really find out if people are thinking about suicide.
So what we're here to talk about is about getting ahead of that, and as opposed to trying to figure out in the aftermath, what did I miss, what went wrong. So let's get into the details of the events that you have planned here at EKU for World Suicide Prevention _ Week. Are these events open to the public?
Yes. So from September 4th to September 10th, the EKU Suicide Awareness and Focus on Education Grant and the Department of Psychology are sponsoring, along with our partners on campus, a schedule of events. On September 4th, we're proud to have Lieutenant Governor Jeanine Hampton as one of our Question, Persuade, and Refer Suicide Prevention Gatekeeper Trainers at the Madison County Library. And it's in this training where we'll be introducing community members. You know, you don't have to be a clinician to attend this training. It's free. It's open to the public. We encourage the entire community to attend and learn. How do you feel more comfortable perhaps asking that question? Are you having thoughts of suicide? And then if somebody says, yes, I am, what you can do?
And that's the role of a suicide prevention gatekeeper?
Yeah. We are all gatekeepers. Everybody. I mean, if you're a receptionist in a dental office or a doctor's office, or you're a school teacher or a custodian or a school bus driver, we're all gatekeepers. So just living in a community makes us a gatekeeper. We all need to feel more comfortable asking that question directly.
So this session would help us sharpen our awareness then?
Absolutely.
And again, the time and place?
The Question, Persuade, and Refer Suicide Prevention Gatekeeper Training is going to be at the Madison County Library on Wednesday, September 4th from 6 to 7:45 p.m. It's going to be in the new community room, and we welcome the entire public to come.
Okay, I see on your schedule that on Friday, September 6th, you have Assessment and Management of Suicide Risk for Behavioral Health Professionals. Might be obvious, but who is the audience for this?
Yeah, this audience is really more of a clinical audience. So we are encouraging those individuals who want to get the CEUs that they need, that are required to get in order to renew their license, to attend this training and learn more about sort of more in-depth questioning, really what to look for and how to respond appropriately in a clinical setting.
And that will happen where and when?
That will happen on Friday, September 6th at the Perkins Building. It'll be an all-day event from 8:30 to 4:30, and they'll be able to find out more information through the EKU Safe website at EKU. That website is suicideprevention.eku.edu.
And then on Tuesday, September 10th, you have something called not prevention, but artvention.
Yes.
What's that about, and where and when is that happening?
Yes. Well, Tuesday, September 10th is actually World Suicide Prevention Day.
Uh-huh.
So all this whole schedule of events is really in honor of that day, which recognizes the problem of suicide and then what we can do, but then also those individuals who have been touched by suicide in some way. Either they themselves have made an attempt or perhaps they've lost a loved one to suicide. And so this event, Artvention, is a joyous art event that occurs in the Noel Studio on the campus of EKU. It occurs from 5 to 8 p.m. And it's just it's an art event. It's for those individuals whose lives have been touched in some way. Either they've made an attempt themselves or lost a loved one to suicide. But it's a way of acknowledging their journey, perhaps their feelings of grief, but also what else is possible from this experience.
Once these three events have occurred, what do you hope for in terms of outcomes?
So what we're really trying to do is raise awareness, not just about the problem of suicide, but also what kind of resources are available for everybody in our community, whether you're a suicide prevention gatekeeper, whether you're a clinician, or whether you're somebody who's really had a close experience with suicide. We want you to know that there are resources available to you. And then also for those individuals who perhaps are struggling, we want them to know that it's okay. It's safe to talk about it, and there are resources for them. There are also suicide-focused treatments available, and I train all of our clinical psychology doctoral students in the Department of Psychology in these suicide-focused treatments, and we provide them through the EKU Psychology Clinic. So most importantly, what we're also wanting to do is raise awareness, let people know that there are resources available in an attempt to save lives.
Okay, we will post the schedule for these events on our website, esweku.com. It'll be there under the Facts and Information tab. You can download it from that. Is there also a web page on the EKU site that people can go to?
Yes, we have a suicide prevention website, and that is suicidepreventionsuicide.edu. www.eku.edu, and there will be information about all of these events on that website as well.
Psychologist Melinda Moore. Dr. Moore is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Eastern Kentucky University, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, the latest developments in hemp farming, production, and industry oversight, and is Kentucky ready for medical marijuana? I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Hemp is rapidly establishing as a growing Kentucky industry, and the market is responding. WEKU's Stu Johnson was on hand for a recent update on Kentucky hemp cultivation and production.
How are we all doing today? Good. So far, so good. We ordered up a good day so far, right? All right, good.
Extension specialist Bob Pierce opened up the Hemp Field Day gathering at the University of Kentucky's Research Farm off Ironworks Pike. The initial expectation was for a crowd of about 500, but by mid-morning, Pierce estimated the final count near 700. Richmond farmer Charles Reese is just beginning to investigate hemp. He grew tobacco for three decades before the federal buyout almost 15 years ago. He's looking at hemp with a curious eye.
I just hope it ain't a fad, is what I hope, you know what I'm saying. I hope it pans out for all the farmers that want to grow it. I'm interested in growing the CBD hemp. I'm not interested in commercial hemp.
Another field day participant looking for more information was Kelly Ramsey of Ramsey Farm in Nicholasville. While thoroughbreds have been the bread and butter of the bluegrass farm, Ramsey says there are challenges in the horse business.
We've been in it for a long time, 30, 40 years, and mainly driven by my father, and he's getting a little bit longer tooth, as he says, and he's wanting to just kind of look into other interests and downsize his horse racing business a bit.
Ramsey says their farm grew 5 acres of hemp 2 years ago, and this year they're growing 20 acres. He envisions the cannabidiol oil business to be a niche market, with maybe more long-term benefits in hemp fiber.
Okay, here we go. One, two, thank you very much.
Included in the hundreds gathering at the research farm was a group of FFA students from Eastern Kentucky. Caitlin Cantrell, who lives on a farm in Lawrence County, finds hemp intriguing, but not something her family is exploring now.
We only have about 60 acres, so we don't really have, and we run cattle on most of it, so, and lease it out and stuff, so we don't really have enough room for stuff like that, but I think it would be interesting to have some around where we are.
A large percentage of farmers sitting at tables under the big tent on a hot August day came from a Kentucky community. But the field day event also drew visitors from about 20 states. Larry Smart is with Cornell University's Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva, New York.
In our research program, we're testing 30 different hemp varieties this year for cannabidiol production, and there's been a lot of investment in processing facilities in New York as well. But we also hope that, and we have some companies that are developing for grain and fiber production as well.
UK Extension Specialist Bob Pierce says compared to decades of research for crops like corn and soybeans, hemp research is still in its infancy. He says there are variety trials, herbicide trials, and fertilizer trials, for example. His advice for any farmer considering hemp is to do a lot of homework up front.
Find a processor that you're going to work with. I would not start into this crop without having some kind of agreement with a processor to know what I'm growing, where I'm going to sell it, and what kind of return I can expect to get for it.
UK agricultural economist Will Snell calls it a new era, adding all those who attended the Field Day event were learning from each other about hemp. Depending upon who you talk to, Snell says, some farmers will say hemp production has gone well, while others will say it hasn't gone well at all. And many Kentucky farmers still grow burley.
I often say, you know, it's not necessarily that hemp's going to jump way over top of tobacco. Tobacco may fall just below hemp, the way that the trend lines are falling. But this book hasn't been written. We're on about chapter one or two, and we'll see where it goes in the coming years.
Snell says tobacco in Kentucky has gone from a $900 million ag industry to $300 million. He says last year farmers sold just under $18 million of hemp to Kentucky processors. Still, Kentucky Ag Commissioner Ryan Quarles holds out high hopes for hemp. He told participants 1,000 farmers were growing hemp in Kentucky this year, up from 200 last year. The state agriculture official got an applause when he said, quote, "If there is ever a state that will capture the economic potential of hemp, it's going to be the Commonwealth of Kentucky, because we are its natural home." I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Know anybody using CBD in some form or another for some ailment or another? It's hard to find anybody who hasn't at least tried out this product of hemp, but it's a challenge to know with certainty about purity and that you're using safe dosage. What standards can we turn to? Here to talk about that is Jonathan Miller, at one time Kentucky's Secretary for Finance and Administration, and these days General Counsel for the U.S. Hemp Roundtable. And it's in that capacity that he joins us today. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be with you, Tom.
You represent the U.S. Hemp Roundtable. What is this organization? How does it differ from the U.S. Hemp Authority?
So the U.S. Hemp Roundtable was started under a different name back in 2013, after Kentucky had made the progress to legalize hemp. There was a desire to have a trade organization, an advocacy organization that could help get hemp legalization passed on the federal level as well as in 49 other states. And so what started with four Kentucky companies in my basement in Lexington has now grown to over 80 companies from across the country representing every aspect of the industry, from the farmers, the seed, all the way to the sale of the final products. It has really been the most responsible organization for lobbying for what now is the permanent legalization of hemp under the 2018 Farm Bill. And these days we're focused on both the state-by-state approach. We've gotten hemp and CBD legalized in states as like Ohio and Texas and Florida, as well as working with the FDA to develop a regulatory structure to promote safe and legal hemp and hemp-derived CBD.
And so I want to talk to you about that. You are developing guidelines, and I think you're in the second iteration of that. Where does that stand? And tell us about that process.
Sure. So the U.S. Hemp Roundtable collected data and garnered public input for a couple years. And at the beginning of 2018, we established an organization called the U.S. Hemp Authority. And the U.S. Hemp Authority has been created to develop and promote and audit and ensure the best practices and the highest standards and self-regulation for the industry. Any good agricultural commodity has self-regulation. It's about the good guys in the industry weeding out the bad guys and trying to ensure that it holds itself to the highest standards. And so the U.S. Hemp Authority has developed a guidance plan. We're now seeking public comment for the second version of that guidance plan. And companies that pass through that guidance, who pass an independent audit that they're actually meeting those standards, are allowed to put a seal of certification on their products that is a signal to customers that the products are legal and a signal to law enforcement that they're legal.
So the U.S. Hemp Authority is part of the roundtable.
Well, there were separate organizations. It's been spun off. The U.S. Hemp Authority needs to be an independent watchdog. It's hired a company called Where Food Comes From that performs independent audits. But the U.S. Hemp Roundtable has been supportive of creating it and ensuring it had the seed funding. Now it is financially self-sufficient based on fees it assesses to companies that want the certification.
So how have these guidelines evolved with version 2? Are there significant changes that that you want to note?
Yeah, you know, we have certified 22 companies now through the Guidance Plan 1.0, and I know a few dozen will come more before the end of the year. 2.0 will take effect next year, and it will be even more stringent. We're focused on making sure that hemp products and hemp CBD meets all of the FDA guidelines. But we go beyond the FDA guidelines. We are requiring companies to have a country of origin listing. A lot of fear about some hemp coming from countries like China, where might be inferior hemp, so that customers will know where the products come from, whether they're made in the USA or Europe or elsewhere. We also are not going to certify CBD products that come from synthetic CBD. They must come from hemp. We're really trying to hold ourselves to high safety and high quality standards.
I would think that in the case of consumables, like the oils, for example, that there would be concerns about what's on that hemp, what sorts of pesticides or herbicides might be on them that could be toxic and dangerous.
Absolutely. And so we require very extensive certificates of analyses that are, again, examined by these independent auditors to take a look at not only THC levels to make sure that they are hemp and compliant with the federal and state laws, but also things like heavy metals to ensure that the products that are being sold out there are safe. You know, Tom, the biggest problem our industry faces is not from law enforcement. It's from these bad actor companies that go out and make crazy claims for their products, or who make products that have high pesticides in them or potentially other toxic substances. And we want people to know when the U.S. Hemp Authority seal is on that product, they will know that it's safe, and that they will know that if they use it as directed, they're not going to get sick, and that they might actually benefit their health and wellness.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that this is a proactive effort to kind of get ahead of the possibility of over-regulation by the federal government, to kind of self-police ahead of that. Is that a correct assessment?
That's a good assessment. I mean, we embrace the FDA coming forward with a regulatory structure. They have stated that they're going to lay out their timeline for regulating CBD in early fall. But we've met with the FDA. I testified at the FDA's public hearing. I met privately with their most senior officials. And I think we've given them some confidence that the industry is taking this proactive self-regulatory effort so that it's still important for there to be a government agency overseeing all of this, but understanding that like the beef industry or like the corn industry, that those agricultural commodities are taking themselves to the highest standards. Hemp is doing the same sort of thing, and that's going to give the FDA comfort that they won't have to be everywhere when they can't afford to be everywhere.
As I mentioned earlier, many who suffer chronic pain are turning to CBD products for relief. Would any standards developed by the industry provide the consumer with research-driven information?
You know, right now our focus is on safety, and our focus is to try to be very transparent about how many milligrams of a product and what actually is being contained in each product, and having some standardization, and that's what the authority will do. In terms of medical benefits, that's still under research right now. We, in order to comply with our standards as well as the FDA standards, a CBD company is not allowed to make medical claims. It can't claim that this product is going to help with pain or cure cancer or cure some other disease. Those types of issues are being researched, and we're very hopeful that drugs will go through the FDA process that will be approved for those purposes. But right now, millions of Americans are taking these products for their general health and wellness. Some find relief in certain areas, others don't. But we're at this point not permitted to make any medical claims.
Well, those dosages seem to be all over the map right now. I've seen a 100 milligram CBD balm labeled extra strength, air quotes, But a quick online search brings up CBD balms of up to 5,000 milligrams. So isn't it in the industry's interest to get a handle on that and make it clear to consumers just what it is they're getting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we really believe very strongly in transparency. We want customers to know what they're getting when they order something. But we're also cognizant that the FDA is looking at the science, and we prepared a lot of scientific research for the FDA as they're going through this process to determine what the safe levels are, that there is going to be a standard set, we think very soon by the FDA, a certain milligram level above which only CBD can be marketed as a drug that goes through the FDA process, and below which it will be considered safe to use for over-the-counter nutraceutical dietary supplement purposes.
Coming over to the business side, what kinds of banking issues are out there that need to be addressed?
You know, it's a big challenge in the industry. The federal law, the 2018 Farm Bill, should have made it very clear that hemp and hemp-derived CBD are legal. Unfortunately, there are still a number of banks, mostly national banks, that are fearful of overregulation or fearful that they're going to lose their federal charters if they engage in these businesses. And so we're really engaged in an educational campaign. We're also working with Congressman Andy Barr here in Central Kentucky, who is soon going to be introducing legislation that will direct the federal financial agencies to instruct banks and credit card companies, et cetera, that it is legal to engage in hemp and hemp CBD. Banks don't have to do it. They're allowed to transact business with whom they want to, but we want them to understand that they're permitted to do it. And I think in the interest of capitalism, once they get that direction, you're going to see a lot more banks open up to this kind of business.
So what is the hemp industry's posture concerning movements to legalize medical and even recreational marijuana?
We're agnostic. We have folks in our industry who are very passionate pro-marijuana legalization and others who are hostile to it, who believe that marijuana is a dangerous product for whatever reason. And so we stay out of those debates, but we work very closely with folks who both support and oppose the industry to understand the differences between hemp and marijuana and to figure out that there are some real clear benefits to hemp-only products like hemp CBD.
There is a perception among some here in Kentucky that hemp production has been diverted mostly into CBD, and that has come at the expense of other products that could be manufactured from the fiber, for example. Is that an accurate perception?
Well, right now, hemp CBD is the most popular and most marketable hemp product on the market today. There are estimates that it could be a $22 billion market by 2022. And so it is very simple for a farmer here in Kentucky to grow their crop and find somebody in the state who does the kind of processing and goes directly into the CBD business. The prices that they can accumulate for their crops are very good, very profitable. But we think that the long run, you're going to still see CBD as very popular, but there's going to be other cannabinoids that will be investigated. And most importantly, as you mentioned, in Europe, hemp fiber is used for all sorts of applications, hemp plastics, hemp manufacturing, hemp concrete. The paneling in many BMWs from Europe are made of hemp. And that, to me, is going to be one of the most profitable areas. Right now, it takes a lot of money for infrastructure, so we're going to start seeing companies do this. Ecofiber just announced and broke ground on a facility in Georgetown, which will take hemp fiber and put it into these kinds of consumer goods, and I think that that will be the real wave and where we'll see real opportunities for our farmers when it comes to hemp fiber.
Jonathan Miller, General Counsel for the U.S. Hemp Roundtable. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Hemp's cousin, marijuana, while not federally sanctioned, has widespread approval across the country for either medical or recreational use or both. And Kentucky is kicking the tires on the medical version, at least. Ben Chandler heads the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, and he's preparing to host a day-long forum in Lexington titled Medical Marijuana, Fact and Fiction, Practical Public Health Policy Considerations for Kentucky. And we invited Ben here to tell us what's on the agenda. Welcome, Ben Chandler.
Well, good to be with you, Tom.
So why medical marijuana and why now?
Well, we think its time has not only come, but probably according to public opinion and according to what other states have done, its time is even beyond ripe. We think that something will be dealt with probably in the next General Assembly. Some law will be put in place in the next General Assembly. And we think that ultimately, one of the most important services that we can do is give opinion leaders and citizens, essentially, of Kentucky some idea about where this issue stands relative to people's health. And we think there's an enormous amount of misinformation. There's misinformation related to whether these products are, whether they really do help, whether they really are effective for medical purposes. And there's misinformation about the use of the products and how they impact acute pain, depression, mental issues, and so forth. There are a lot of things that they impact, but also we want to talk about the state of the law throughout the country, what has happened in different jurisdictions. We're having the person who was the architect of the Colorado law and the Colorado system come and talk to us at this forum about it and about what the experience has been in Colorado. And then there are the potential negative things. Are these items bad for your health? You know, if you ingest them, if you smoke them, what's the effect on your lungs?
Right.
You know, we have all kinds of trouble with vaping now in our society. We're hearing more and more horror stories about that. What do we need to do to protect the public from any potential health harms, and all at the same time provide access to the benefits of these products?
I think 34 states have now legalized marijuana in one form or another, either for medical purposes or medical and recreational. So there are that many states out there that are in play. You mentioned Colorado, and that one of your speakers is actually the architect of the Colorado law. Is Colorado a model for Kentucky, for other states? And are we going to hear from him some of the outcomes?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call Colorado a model, because Colorado went all the way and they legalized it for essentially any purpose, recreational included. So Colorado's probably gone further than Kentucky is.
So a little bit more difficult to distinguish the medical from
the outcome of the medical. Well, it is, and that's where part of the misinformation comes in. There is a difference between medical use and recreational use. Now, that being said, there are, I think, maybe as many as 12 states in this country now who have actually legalized it for recreational use as well as medical use, and the entire nation of Canada has on our northern border. So I mentioned that, and you said the 33 or 4 states that have legalized medical marijuana. That's an enormous number, and what it tells me is that it's coming. Now, we're not even going to be able to enforce the laws efficiently in this state and fairly if most of the country allows these products to be legal.
Well, let's get into that public opinion. There have been all kinds of polls out there. Tell us what you
see. And I think it's really interesting. We did a poll as far back as 2012. The Foundation for Healthy Kentucky did. It was a big poll of 1,500 respondents, which is quite sizable. And we asked them if Kentucky residents were in favor or opposed buying and using marijuana for medical purposes if a doctor recommends it. At that time, and this is 7 years ago, 78% of Kentuckians approved of it. Now, that's a substantial number. And that number, I think, has done nothing but grow since then. In 2018, there was a National Harris poll, and that poll showed that 85% of Americans felt like marijuana ought to be legalized. And later that year, Gallup did a poll that asked about marijuana for any use, meaning medical or recreational. And even in that poll, 66% of our fellow countrymen approved of that. They were in favor of it. And in fact, 53% of Republicans were, a majority of Republicans were. So it was really interesting. This is an issue that, as far as public opinion is concerned, we're way past the tipping point.
Is there solid research out there to support the idea that medical marijuana taken in whatever dosage or whatever form does in fact address things like chronic or acute pain?
Well, we're going to find out about that at this forum. Mm-hmm. I think there is certainly evidence to that effect. Now, how proven it is, you know, how good the evidence is, that's another question. But we think that there's certainly anecdotal evidence. So we're going to delve into what the real story is as best we can and get experts to tell us.
We have such a pain management problem in this state, in this country for that matter, but it's really acute in Kentucky. Can we reasonably look at medical marijuana as a possible safer alternative to opioids?
Well, I think one thing that the adherents of legalizing medical marijuana will tell you right away is that nobody overdoses from medical marijuana, and people do overdose clearly from opioid use. So the real question is whether it works or not and whether it will give you the kind of relief that you can get from opioid medications. But there is at least anecdotal evidence out there that suggests that it does give substantial relief in some cases. But we don't have the kind of clinical studies we'd like to have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
You know, I think you're right. There is a lot of confusion out there, about, especially with the rise of hemp and CBD oil. It's easy to confuse the two.
Well, it really is. The CBD oil is part of the hemp plant, and CBD oil does not get you high like THC does, which is another constituent part of that plant. And you can separate CBD from THC. So you right now in Kentucky, CBD is legal. You can use that for the benefits, and there are people who swear by those benefits. Now, there are also others who say it hadn't done them any good. So, you know, again, we've got anecdotal evidence, but we don't have clinical studies. What we need at some point are some clinical studies done, I think, by the FDA, if we're ever going to get to an absolute decision. I don't think we really have time for that as far as whether we legalize marijuana or not for medical purposes here in Kentucky, because essentially the horse is already out of the barn nationally.
A Republican-sponsored bill actually put forth by Representative Jason Nemes that would legalize medical marijuana was approved 16-1 by the House Judiciary Committee in last year's session and voted out of committee for the first time ever by a huge majority. It didn't reach the House floor, but Representative Nemes tells me that he's going to reintroduce it. What do you think are its chances?
Well, when anything gets in front of the legislature, it's a question of what the priorities are in any given session. They've got time to do what they want to do. And if it doesn't get high enough in the priority level, or if it's controversial enough, they may conveniently run out of time, shall we say. But I think based on the numbers that I gave you a little earlier, the amount of support that there is amongst the general public, both in Kentucky and nationally, for the legalization of medical marijuana, I would be very surprised if they did not bring it up and allow a vote on the floor. I think the chances are very good for it in the next session.
And what you're saying is that if the political cover is there, then something can move forward. Do you sense, given the public opinion that you've cited, that we're there now?
Well, having been in politics for a long time, I can tell you that people who are elected to political office pay a great deal of attention to what their constituents want. And when the numbers are as one-sided as these are, this is essentially 80% you don't see that number very often on any issue.
No.
80% in favor of it. It's very hard to continue to prevent this from happening.
Before we run out of time, I want to make sure and get back to the forum. Basically, the details, the date, location?
It's September 23rd, and it's here in Lexington at the Marriott Hotel. And anybody who's interested can register, but we would suggest that you hurry because we are filling up pretty quick.
Where can people go to do that?
At our website. And that's the website of the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky. You can just Google Foundation for Healthy Kentucky. It'll take you right there.
Okay, and we'll be sure and put a link to that on our site as well.
Wonderful.
Ben Chandler is president and CEO of the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. Thanks for coming in, Ben.
Thank you, Tom.
According to the National Institutes of Health, recent clinical trials with marijuana indicate that it can be useful in the management of neuropathic pain, spasticity due to multiple sclerosis, and possibly other indications. As with all medications, benefits and risks have to be weighed. Coming up after the break, Lexington, Kentucky is a city that loves its trees. And word of some serious jazz heading our way from New York City. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The trees in our lives are there day after day, never judging us, never talking back, just quietly providing. One recent report suggested that if we plant a lot of them, like a trillion, we might stop climate change in its tracks. We do know that we can't live without them and their absorption of carbon dioxide and the oxygen that they emit. People in Lexington, Kentucky are making plans to devote a week of focus on trees, and here to tell us about it are Bridget Abernathy, Urban Forestry Partnership Coordinator at the Kentucky Division of Forestry, and Heather Wilson, Municipal Arborist for the City of Lexington. Bridget and Heather are Tree Week Core team members, and thanks for coming in to tell us about this Tree Week, which is happening October 12th through the 19th. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us today.
Heather, how would you assess the condition of Lexington's treescape or tree canopy?
Well, I believe that Lexington's treescape is ever-changing. We did a study back in 2013, 2015, which gave us an estimate of a tree canopy cover about 25%. Things are always changing due to disease and trees dying or trees being planted. But I do believe today that we are on an upswing for tree canopy. The majority of our forest, I feel, is healthy. I will say that just in our Division of Environmental Services with LFUCG, we have planted over probably 1,000 trees in the past 3 years, and that doesn't include the trees that we've planted with reforested bluegrass events. So we're increasing our urban forest canopy greatly, I feel, each year.
Bridget, how about statewide? How would you describe the condition of these forest lands?
Currently, Kentucky's forest lands are made up of about 12 million acres, so it's about half the state. And we have mainly an oak hickory component to that in our Appalachian area and various other forest types throughout the state. So we have more forest than we did. We've been building over the past decades from the Industrial Revolution. So the acreage has increased over time. The median age of the forest has increased. But we also have active timber industry and recreation industry and other factors that affect our forest. With increased recreation, I think there's a great opportunity to bring people to different areas of Kentucky who haven't been to those areas to see our natural beauty and hopefully to increase to some of the economic development in some areas that have less accessibility.
And I know Tree Week is not about climate change. This is coming from me. It's not coming from you. But I had to ask you about this because we're talking trees. There's this Swiss study out there that was published in July that got a lot of notice. It was first published in the journal Science, and it suggests that climate change could be greatly mitigated, if not ended, by simply planting a lot of trees. They call for a trillion trees. And some say that we don't have nearly enough room on the planet to do that and also feed the world. But what's your take on this idea of mitigating climate change by planting more trees?
Well, trees intake carbon dioxide, and they're a huge solution to the climate change problem. In the U.S., we have large land area, and specifically in Kentucky, we have a great percentage of our land area that is privately owned. And so with that in mind, I think there's huge potential to increase the tree cover in certain areas of Kentucky through initiatives not just on public land, but on private land, whether or not that's through small community projects, large reforestation projects, through some of the initiatives with reclamation and other initiatives.
Okay, let's come around to Tree Week.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second annual Tree Week.
It is.
Is it? Okay. I know there are some events happening in the weeks leading up to the week in October, including some movies. Do one of you want to tell us about that?
I'll let Bridget speak a little bit to the movies. I will mention that one of the events that's happening pre-Tree Week, that Friday afternoon at the Northside Branch Library out Russell Cave Road, we'll be planting two trees this year to be our signature Tree Week trees. One will be the Bur Oak, which is representative of our official Lexington City tree, and another will be a Redbud. The North Branch Library has been more than willing to help us do this, and this will be ideally something we continue each year to celebrate Tree Week.
For the movies that will be shown, there's a couple movies that will be shown at the Lexington Public Libraries. So they're geared toward kids, but not necessarily. They're family-oriented. We have The Lorax that will be shown, as well as a movie called Fern Gully, which focuses on rainforests. So these are animated films, and they're free and open to the public.
So let's get into the week of October. There is a lot going on. I've been on your website, and you have a lot of things happening. We just have a limited amount of time here, so maybe just some highlights here, and anybody who wants to know more can find the details online. And Bridget, what's that web address?
The web address is ufi.ca.uky.edu/treeweek2019.
Okay, and we're going to post that link under the Facts and Information tab on our website as well on esweku.com. So, those highlights.
We have about 40 events registered this year so far for Tree Week. Last year, we had about 60 events throughout the city. And this year, we expect to have about the same amount by the time that October rolls around. Some of the events range from small tree planting events. Others are talks and workshops. But some of the most notable ones that we wanted to talk about, preceding Tree Week, there's going to be a gallery hop photography show that focuses on trees. There will be, of course, the tree essay contest. We do have a kickoff event that is in collaboration with Seedleaf at their urban farm. The Urban Forest Initiative is hosting a mulching event, and that's at Castlewood Park, where there's some very large trees that need protection. So it's not just about planting, but also about the care and maintenance of trees. There are many events happening at Fayette County Public Schools. So these are not open to the public, but they're involving the kids that attend those schools. And those are tree plantings that will happen at six schools throughout Lexington. And one of the events that's a little different, and this is outside Fayette County, is called Trees Out in the Country. And it is an event at Oakland Farm Trees in Bourbon County, where many trees are grown, and there'll be a couple walking tours and workshops there as well.
Is there anything that we've missed about Tree Week here that you want to add?
I wanted to add that this initiative started with the Urban Forest Initiative Working Group, which was born out of a group of faculty and staff and tree lovers and tree professionals in 2014 out of UK. And the working group is made up of members from throughout the community who are tree-focused individuals. And this initiative wouldn't be possible without all of the event hosts and partners, as well as committed community members who either host events or attend the events. So it's a community effort.
And you, Heather, anything you'd like to add?
Yes, I wanted to add that the goal behind Tree Week was really to work to connect people with trees throughout the community in ways that maybe are obvious and in other ways that are maybe not so obvious to them. We just felt that maybe there's a lot of times that people tend to go toward trees, to that shade or that calmness, without really realizing it. We're hoping to kind of highlight that with all the different kinds of events throughout of Tree Week. I also wanted to mention, too, that hosting event is open to absolutely anyone throughout the community. It does not have to be someone that's done it in the past. If you have an idea for an event and you would like to tie it into Tree Week, you just can reach us through that Tree Week website that we've given previously, and there's a form to fill out to submit your event, and please do.
Okay, this is going to be a lot of fun, really interesting, and it's okay to be a tree hugger.
It is.
Great.
All right. We have Bridget Abernathy, Urban Forestry Partnership Coordinator at the Kentucky Division of Forestry, and Heather Wilson, Municipal Arborist for the City of Lexington. Thank you both for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We're launching another new feature on Eastern Standard, Who, What, Where, Why, and When, about community events. First up, Richard Young of the Origins Jazz Series on the first performance of the new season. Who's on deck, Richard?
Yeah, so we're bringing in the Orrin Evans Trio all the way from New York. Orrin Evans is a famous jazz pianist. He's the pianist with The Bad Plus, which is a trio that we brought in last year, and he's coming back bringing his own trio. That's also going to be featuring Jeff Tane Watts, the famous drummer.
What kind of music?
So yeah, this is going to be like pretty standard piano trio music with a little bit more of a like modernist jazz take on it. So think kind of like 2019 version of the Bill Evans Trio.
Where is this happening?
It's happening at the Downtown Arts Center on Main Street.
When is it happening?
It's going to be on September 6th at 7:30 p.m.
Why do we want to be there?
Very rarely do you get an opportunity, I think, to hear a really high-quality jazz trio in a really intimate setting. So we're really excited to be presenting this at the Downtown Arts Center because we're actually going to be doing it in the round. So the audience is going to be on all four sides of it. We're going to have an amazing Steinway piano there. And it's going to be like a really fascinating, intimate opportunity to hear these amazing musicians in person.
Tickets?
So you can purchase tickets by going to originsjazz.org, and it'll redirect you to the Downtown Arts Center's website, and you can purchase tickets through them.
Richard Young of the Origins Jazz Series. Learn more online at originsjazz.org. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.